Good evening, everybody. I'm John Cruickshank from the Canadian Journalism Foundation. I have a day job working with Kevin and trying to keep him out of trouble. I'm not doing a very good job so far. I'm delighted to see the house full. This is an enormously important talk. This is the core subject of our work, I believe. But let me first express the gratitude of the organization to BMO Financial Group. They are the exclusive supporters of JTalk, the exclusive sponsors, and they're the ones who have allowed us to carry on this conversation with the community over a prolonged period, and it's been great. If you want to join the conversation directly, you can do that via Twitter on hashtag CJFJTalk. These are the indispensable members of our tribe. Right? This is what it's most important for us to do. From time to time, you will hear editors and publishers say, "Oh well, all stories should be investigative." And that may or may not be true in some sense, but I've found that when you actually investigate that kind of statement, the work of those newsrooms are not investigative, right? That to get great investigative reporting, you have to have great investigators. You have to have people who have a methodology and who have a passion to implement it. And they then model a kind of behavior that can create an investigative urge and trend throughout all of your other reporting. But without that, you don't get the benefits. And much more importantly, the community doesn't get the benefits. One of the things that I think is often thought, perhaps romanticized a little bit inside the business, is that investigative reporting is really popular. People have said to me a lot over the last several years, largely because of Kevin's work, "Boy, this must be a great time for readership at the Star. You must be selling a lot of papers." And the reality is, sorry, Kevin, that's not true. Right? Investigative reporting is often divisive. It's always highly controversial. It hurts feelings. It annoys communities. And it's absolutely vital to the health of those communities over a long time. And frankly, it's vital to our profession and to our titles over a long time. Because it may hurt in the day, but over time, it tells people why we're here. It's a sign of life, and it's deeply important. Anyway, you have here a panel that is going to give you a much clearer sense of that than I. Let me start with Kevin Donovan, the investigative reporter and editor at the Toronto Star. His recent work has included reporting on allegations of violence and sexual harassment against Gian Gomeshi, the former host of CBC Radio's Q, and on scandals surrounding Rob Ford, the former mayor of Toronto. He is among the recipients of the 2014 CJF Tribute to Investigative Journalism, has won 3 National Newspaper Awards, 2 Michener Awards, and 3 Canadian Association of Journalism Awards. Diana Swain, CBC News' senior investigative journalist. Her recent work has included the groundbreaking investigation into Scouts Canada's handling of sex abuse allegations, which recently received the prestigious Hillman Award, an investigation into the millions of Canadian tax dollars hidden in offshore accounts, and a report on the Canadian military's response to the needs of returning soldiers now struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder. She's received 8 Gemini nominations, recognizing her writing, reporting, and anchoring. She's won the Gemini for Best News Anchor 3 times and was the first woman in Canada to win the award. About our moderator, Paula Todd. She is an investigative journalist, author, broadcaster, and lawyer. She was the first in Canada to break news in an e-book with Finding Carla, How I Tracked Down an Elusive Child Serial Killer and Discovered a Mother of 3. Her latest book is Extreme Mean, Trolls, Bullies, and Predators Online, which uncovers the real reasons people cyber abuse. A professor of digital journalism and broadcast, Paula sits as the digital issues chair on the CJFE board and is at work on her 4th book. With that, I'll turn it over to your panel.
Thank you so much, John. Oh, you can hear me too. How wonderful. Thank you for being here. I wish I could start asking you a question first. What does make investigative journalism and the journalists who practice it so interesting? But the first thing I want to ask you is, does it embarrass you at all to be called an investigative journalist? I have many colleagues who work in newsrooms around the world, and they often say, but I investigate every day. Why am I not called an investigative journalist? Kevin?
My first question is, do I look at Paula, or I'm going to be looking back and forth.
Cut the
difference. COVID doesn't look shifty. if you look at my byline, in the certainly in the print edition, it says staff reporter. It probably always will say that. Occasionally I notice it says investigative reporter online. I didn't put that in. But I think all reporters who make the second and third and fourth phone call or go to somebody's house and ask them to reveal some information that they don't want to reveal about an important public issue, all those people are investigative reporters. I think that many people in our newsroom are investigative reporters, even if they don't work on my team. Lately, people have been referring to certain reporters in Canada as investigative reporters, and I'm not a big fan of the term. I do find, though, when you call up people, it helps a little bit to say, at least, you know, that I do investigations for the Star.
I find that makes them hang up. It really depends, doesn't it?
But sometimes you can have dinner with them and they leave and then they come back.
What about you?
It took a while.
Did you get that? but what about you? Because certainly, you know, part of doing your job well as a reporter is to make the second phone call, as Ray Timpson used to tell us. But there is a point at which you realize more is being invested in your work. You're being given more time than just the daily, you know, hit me with this, you got to file, you got to go. How do you tell the difference?
No, I think sometimes, you know, the metaphor is very simplistic, but daily journalism, which is just as useful and just as important, I think that's part of the distinction we want to make, is that we don't necessarily see ourselves as contributing more or doing better work, but different work. You know, a daily journalist is out covering a house fire, say, for example. You know, there's the house fire, the questions that you're asking. Do people nearby need to stay in their homes? Is there someone in the house? You know, how did it start? All of this sort of present questions. The investigative journalist is the one who says, do you see that house? There was a fire in there that nobody knows about. And I'm going to tell you how it started and why it started. And here's what we've found. You're actually coming at journalism from a slightly different part of the spectrum. And I think that's part of the job. And you're finding things that are not readily apparent. And that's part of why it takes so long, why your byline or my report seem to disappear sometimes. So because of the amount of time that goes into finding something that is not readily apparent, readily available, and not easy to get hold of.
I really liked what you said, that we come at it from a different angle, because as soon as you painted the picture of a burning house, I know that I would probably get around to that story when it turns out, you know, when we scrape the data and we see that 15 houses have burned the same month in the same pattern in different neighborhoods. And why does that make it different, Kevin?
Well, I mean, I think that you're talking about looking at a database type project, which we've done many of, and some on the Toronto Fire Department. We're trying to do stories that we know it's time to do an investigative story on, if we can use the house fire example, when there's been a rash of fires in a certain area and you want to try and explain why that is happening. Years ago with a colleague, Moira Welsh, did an investigation of child deaths in Ontario and children's aid societies. And that was because Moira spotted, it was covering a case and noticed that there were a number of cases in the child welfare system that seemed to be quite similar. And it was because of that, the aggregate of that, that we decided to do an investigation. We try at the Star to do stories that are in the public interest. And what we mean is that they, not just that they are interesting to the public, but they are about something that is very important, and that by writing about the fires, you might change something in the Toronto Fire Department, for example. So that's the difference. I will just say that, I mean, I've been at the Star now 30 years next April, and I started out as a general assignment reporter. I often speak to journalism classes, and I give them two words of advice. I say, when you go for a job application anywhere, Do not say you want to be a foreign correspondent, and do not say you want to be an investigative journalist. I grew into my role at the Star my first couple of years, because I am a byline counter. I had about 350 bylines every year, and they've been less, but I'm still in the paper a lot now. And what I encourage my team of nine reporters at the Star to do, and our analysts, is to do stories more and more often if they can, because I think the public has a real yearning for that. And I, well, Paula who, and I started together at the Star. You may remember my early days. The story would be, you know, several giant paragraphs. It would occupy four pages, I'm not kidding, in the Toronto Star when it was a broadsheet. And I really would disappear for a year, and I have no interest in that anymore.
But that's interesting, because there's a bit of a stereotype about investigative reporters as loners. They take their cameras, their equipment, their books, their beat up car, and they disappear. You don't look like you have a beat up car.
No, it's pretty nice.
So do you have to be a loner? We work in teams generally now,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah, no, I think the stereotype really is a fair distance from the reality. You know, it may be my face that you see that is part of delivering the product at the end, because that's the nature of the medium that I work in. But we work as a team, and there are a number of us who work together, and we work pretty closely with the rest of the newsroom. I mean, that's part of the dialogue. That's part of the fun, frankly, of being in journalism, is working with the rest of the newsroom. That collegiality and that rush you get when things are coming together is addictive. And once
it is
you
addictive.
Feel that, you can't walk away from it. So I would find it really difficult to be off in some kind of island in isolation on a floor where no one knew where I was. Having said that, there is a different kind of an energy, because you're not necessarily working toward a daily deadline of delivery. You're trying to get the material out as quickly as you can. There's a reason to be there and to be present, but it's a different energy. So as a team, you may be slightly more isolated, but I think increasingly we find ourselves more married to the larger news presence.
That's as all the budget cuts hit us and we move from offices and offices to our all in one little room together. We're back in the little schoolhouse. There is, though, and somebody in the biz asked me to ask this question, there is a cachet about being an investigative reporter in some newsrooms, where you're isolated off to an area, or you have a little cubby hole on a different floor, and you don't have to report back every single day. In fact, sometimes you're gone for a long time, and not only do they not ask, they dare not ask, because they actually don't want to know where you are. That sense of elitism, and I know it's a difficult question perhaps to answer, but it's out there. What do you think about it?
Well, I'm a player coach at the Toronto Star. I do my own stories and sometimes with other reporters. And then I have this team that I manage. And I keep telling John Cruikshank I have two jobs. And he says, well, do you want a third? I don't think we're elitist at all. I think there was a time at the Star when reporters and the investigative team acted more standoffish. And we certainly don't do that now. Those of you, some of you are from my newsroom, but you know, we're in the heart of the newsroom. We often work with other reporters. Tim, one of our great, relatively young compared to me anyways, reporters sitting at the back, Tim Almansiak, he often, works on his own stories, will help us with things. I'd love to have Tim on the team one day, say that publicly. So we try to be more collegial, and I think you really have to do that. Our city editor at the Star, Irene Gentle, and I work very closely together on all of these stories, and I think the big thing that we try to do is that our investigative team tries to help out city side or any other part of the newsroom, and by the same token, people from city side might come and work with us, and it has to be like that. You can't be in this day and age away from the rush of the newsroom. I think it would be boring, actually.
Kevin, the Star appears to have invested lots of staff and lots of money in growing their investigative team, and I would submit that, in fact, you're branding yourself with great investigative pieces. People are starting to reach for the Star because I know there's going to be some substance in that. But many newsrooms, one of the first things that gets cut is, oh, those people who take so long to get their story out. What do you find at CBC?
I mean, I think there has been a reinvestment in investigative, and sometimes this stuff is cyclical because whether it's television or newspapers, I mean, the industry has been squeezed at large. Mm-hmm. And where is the money? Sometimes easy to cut, it's an investigative because you aren't able to deliver every day because it does take more man hours to get a particular story together. There is a different level of investment. But, you know, at CBC, I remember when I started 24 years ago, we had I-teams in all the local newsrooms. Mm-hmm. And for a while that went away because it was considered expensive and it was hard to rationalize. Jennifer McGuire, who's the editor-in-chief, has brought that back. And so I think we're seeing a reinvestment in that because there's a general understanding that it does drive people toward what you are producing. It drives people toward your paper, drives people toward the CBC when we break stories. That's where the real rubber hits the road in this business. And I think that there is an understanding that it's important, but there's also a payoff.
Increasingly, I agree with that. Increasingly, though, now that we have so much data coming to us via the internet and we can scrape data and we can see stories we never could before, is it also the case that we have to invest in investigative journalism because that's the next step? What do we do with all this data if we can't understand it?
I think you have to do that, and I think no matter what newsroom you're in the country, you should be trying to do stories like Paul has just referenced. You should try. I mean, I think every reporter should try and have an investigative story of some type on the go while they're doing all the stuff that they're being asked to do, covering murders and business meetings, things like that. I really try and encourage particularly young journalists to do that. I think you want to, we all tend to mark things in a calendar and you look at your year. And I think every December you should look back and say, did I really contribute something different and unique and exciting to my organization and to the world at large? That's what I try to do. And that's how I got into doing investigative reporting. I was quite a prolific writer of, a terrible writer, but a prolific writer of stories, wrote a lot of stories for The Star. What I wanted to do is do stories that people would talk about. And talk about, you want the government, in the Queen's Park, somebody to stand up and say, there's a problem with this system and it's been in the Toronto Star and we're gonna try and fix it. That should be your goal. You should be trying to do impact journalism. There have been people who, I'm sure, had taken great glee in our Star Gets Action. The reason we do that is we're trying to show that to our sources, the people who come forward to us, if we do a story on your issue and then something gets changed, taxi cabs now in Toronto have to have, there have to be criminal checks. We just did a story on the front page today on violence in the schools, and I think something will flow from that. You should be trying to do these stories, even if you're not on an I-team.
When we talk about the public interest, it's about something that interests the public good, as opposed to something I really want to hear about all the time. I sometimes have to make that distinction for some of my students, and I appreciate it. Those are two excellent examples. Same at CBC, Diana. There are so many stories that you've been a part of breaking that ultimately change the lives of people. And I'm thinking, of course, about the Scout investigation. How does it start? I mean, if I was thinking, what probably people want to know is, how'd you get that story? How did you recognize it as a story? And what did you have to do? We can't tell you everything, but what did you have to do to get the facts and break that story? Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so often stories start in the simplest possible way. You know, people think that it's always driven by a phone call. Someone calls you and you've got the deep throat moment. So often it's simply a question of, I wonder. I wonder how this works. I wonder why that happened. And that's really how that story started, was there was a court case in the U.S., a very small court case at the time, that was dealing with the treatment of a case. I mean, a guy had been abused by his scout leader when he was about 10, 12, and now as an adult, he was trying to pursue some kind of litigation against him because the statute of limitations in the U.S. doesn't leave a lot of room for that. And they were trying to show that there had been a pattern of abuse with this scout leader and that they must have known. Mm-hmm. And so in doing that, they accessed the fact that the Boy Scouts of America had kept what they called perversion files. that went back decades that showed that they in fact knew that they had abusers in their midst. And rather than turn them into police, they would shunt them off to another detachment, essentially, of scouts. The question we had simply was, if that's what they were doing south of the border, what were they doing here? The simplest real question. That led us on really an 18-month odyssey to try to understand how those allegations and concerns had been handled within Scouts Canada. The information was beyond not readily available. Scouts Canada was not helpful at all. Insisted that any time that anyone had ever come to them, they had gone directly to police, that this had rarely happened, that nothing had ever been mishandled. I mean, on the surface of it, it sounds a bit absurd. Never got it wrong? That seems completely unlikely to me. And when someone says never, you know, it's like waving a red flag in front of a journalist. But to get the information we needed meant real old-fashioned gumshoe. I mean, the real counterpoint to what's available right now in terms of the data mining that we can do, to try to get a picture of what we needed to know, we had to go back old school. And I was refreshing my memory on this, in fact, because it was a couple of years ago, but to try to paint a picture for ourselves of how many examples there may have been of scout leaders who had been accused of abusing someone, we had to go to every courthouse in the country and do an actual physical search. And we were talking about microfiche. There might be 10 people in this room who even know what that still means because it doesn't exist anymore. But it was our own compiling of the information that started to push this thing uphill and say there is a much bigger issue here. And ultimately, it forced Scouts Canada to hire KPMG to do its own audit and determine that there had been hundreds of allegations documented and not always delivered to police.
And part of what you just illustrated is really the backbone of investigative journalism. You have to do it all the time, and you have to do really boring things sometimes for a long time, but you also have to do scary things too. Kevin, the big question that I'm sure many people in this room have, you and Robin Doolittle broke the Rob Ford story. You pushed it. You got a result. Most recently, the entire country is talking about the Jeanne Gomeshi story. When you first were approached about this, what did you think?
Well, I thought there was a different Jeanne Gomeshi than the one I've been listening to on Q for the last 7 or 8 years. Jesse Brown, who's a Canada Land podcaster, approached the Star late April. He's a critic of media. That's what he sees as that is his role. And he was approached by people who saw this story as a CBC story. And one woman approached him who had had a story to tell, allegations. If he was here today, he'd say, look, this is not something that he was equipped to deal with. And he talked to the person and believed what she said and talked to another person and then came to the Star. And I recall the meeting when he came into the Star. I was surprised. I knew that he was going to tell us an allegation about somebody, and I was surprised about Gomeshi. I didn't know him at all, except that I happened to like his show. And so I was surprised. And then what I saw at the start of this was a real uphill battle, because when I got involved, in the Rob Ford story long before the crack video, because they needed my expertise to find out if Rob Ford had had a problem at the Garrison Ball. And being somebody in his early 50s, a lot of people who are guys in their early 50s go to the Garrison Ball, and I happen to know a bunch of them, and so was able to get that story out, which caused us to get the phone call about the crack video. I was not at all surprised that Rob Ford would be smoking crack cocaine. It didn't surprise me. But when I heard about the allegation about Gomeshi, my jaw literally dropped. And it's an awful thing to think about somebody who's a cultural icon. Arguably one of the most popular people in CBC's history. And then we just set about over the summer trying to investigate it. It's a tough thing to investigate because you can't started going around to street corners and saying, have you been assaulted by a major CBC host? You just can't do that stuff.
How do you do it?
Well, we began by interviewing the people who, the three or four people who were wanting to come forward to the point of telling their story to the Star. Lengthy interviews with them, you know, as we all do. I'm sure many people here are interviewers, and you try and see, do you believe the person? You're not trying to trip people up, but you're trying to see if their dates and times line up. If, for example, they told stories about alleged assaults when Gomeshi was in Toronto, and then I had to check to see, was he in fact in Toronto? Public person, it's pretty easy to find that out. So things like that, emails, texts, things like that, a lot of the things that we've not shared yet for a whole bunch of reasons, led me to the conclusion over the summer that the women were telling the truth. And then we had we're big at the Star in the responsible communication defense, which we caused to happen in the Supreme Court of Canada. So a big part of that was me going to Gomeshi and trying to get him to answer questions, and tried it in a bunch of different ways, and talked to a lot of people at CBC, and then had this dinner you may have read about with him, where I suggested that he confess to me, and I think actually if he had, things would have gone a little bit differently for him, and then ultimately events unfolded, and the real investigation I find is going on now. The things that I and others are doing now, and we're close to publishing another story involving other victims of Mr. Gomeshi, alleged victims. That's the real investigation, because more people are coming forward, and I think because of the charges, feel a little bit more comfortable in speaking.
That's a really good point. We rely so much on sources, and a lot of times, whether they're whistleblowers in the government or they're people who witnessed frightening things happen, they fear for themselves, they fear for their careers, sometimes even their lives. How do you protect your sources? You protect your sources?
Well, you can to an extent. I mean, you will go to the wall to protect someone who has taken the very difficult step of telling you something that's difficult, that puts them at risk. But in terms of being able to protect their physical safety, I mean, things like that, they're very challenging things to be faced with as a journalist. I mean, you're balancing all sorts of things at the one moment. When someone comes to you and says, here's information that you're not sure you can get any other way, but they're not prepared to do the thing of putting themselves out there. So you have to walk yourself through the test and make sure that you're confident that what they're telling you is true. And trying to comfort yourself and the organization that's going to walk this plank with you.
It's always a balancing act, though, isn't it? And have you ever, the night before something you've worked on for a long time, you've crossed your T's, you've dotted your I's, but there's still, do you sleep the night before a huge story breaks?
I don't.
I sleep really well.
I mean, I think you're comfortable with it. I've never called in the middle of the night and said, I've changed my mind.
Never.
Call it down.
Never.
But there is that sense of, here we go. All of the effort and the time that you have put into a story, with the scouts. I mean, I lost track of how many times somebody was threatening to sue us before we went to air. You know you're right, but you're checking, you're double checking, and so you should.
But it's also, the accuracy is something that, it's lawyered. You've done your work, you've checked it and rechecked it. What I was talking about, though, is that often when we do these pieces, they are going to change people's lives in such a big way. And, we've done the public interest test. This is in the public good. But I can't help but think, and when you look at the Gian Gomeshi case, for example, you knew that a lot of people's lives were going to change, that a business was going to change, and that even the public corporation of CBC that we love was going to change.
Yeah, the Gomeshi story is interesting because I knew that, was confident that the story would eventually come out in some fashion in the Star, I did not predict that it would start what people call the national conversation on sexual assault and sexual harassment, which to me is something that should have been discussed long ago. Now people are discussing it. We were doing at the same time this summer a public investigation into sexual violence on university campuses. Jamie Poisson and Emily Mathieu at the Star on my team did it. And in many ways, that is a much more important work of journalism than the Jean Gomeshi story, because what they did in the space of just a few months is went to every university in Canada and all colleges in Ontario to find out, find cases of sexual violence or allegations of sexual violence and see how the universities were treating them. And they found all sorts of things, some cases, and convinced people to go on the record, on video as well, with our great videographer, Randy Reisling. But they also found out that the universities were completely aware of how they should be dealing with this. And so the thing about the Gomeshi story coming out when it did just coincidentally before we published that is that the universities were way more receptive. They already were probably thinking, geez, you know, we better start doing some changes here. And then we came out with this university story, which is completely unrelated to Gomeshi. And then we started in within a couple of days publishing stories saying that the universities and colleges, not all of them, but a lot of them, were starting to develop policies and have meetings and discussions. So the Gomeshi story is an awful story. It's the worst story I've ever been involved in, but there are some good parts of it.
What about you, Diana? I'm not going to ask you what's the worst, although I'm sure you want to know. You ask that. We're going to have some questions in a little bit, so you ask that. What I'd like to stick with, though, is the notion of change. Mm-hmm. The CBC has been at the heart of changing institutions and changing people's lives since its inception. When you think back on some of the stories that you worked on that had this real effect, what comes to mind?
It's interesting because, I mean, some of them come from the earliest part of my career and some come more recently. You know, the Scouts would be a good example. In terms of getting some accountability for people who had waited a large part of their lives for that, who were now believed, and how much that meant to them. I mean, you know, those parallels exist with the Gomeshi story. One of the first, though, that actually I never forgot about was a northern reserve in northern Manitoba, and the water was badly contaminated. And there had been an appeal from people there for journalists to go up and actually go see. And, you know, it was expensive even then sometimes to get to some of the northern reserves. You had to charter a plane. We went up, and I remember seeing these children who had these terrible rashes on their body. Never forgotten it. And it was unconscionable in this country that we were forcing people to live in those conditions. Written word had not smacked us all the way it should have. The pictures of those kids did. And I remember it was 48 hours, what we then called the Indian Affairs Minister, flew up with a check to fix the water. And it was one of those moments where you saw the cause and effect so quickly, and you realized not only the power that journalists have, but the responsibility we have to make sure the story's right, but to use it to get things fixed, to make things better. I mean, that's ultimately, for me, what this is about. Let's identify things that aren't working and make them better, either by exposing them to people who can change them, or by identifying ways in which they can be fixed.
So we can talk about when we've had success. Can you think of a time, Kevin, when it didn't turn out the way you wanted it to? The story that you'd hoped you found, or maybe you were even wrong.
Well, the worst thing I ever did, and this is not a planted question, it's not a big story at all, but many, many years ago, somebody called me up and said hospitals are starting to bring in dogs and cats to get MRIs at night after 6 to 7 p.m. when the machines are not being used. And so I looked into that and did a story. And the point of the story was I was trying to show that, because people could come in and pay a technician, a veterinary technician, to use these expensive machines. And I was trying to show that these machines should be used more because they, at least at the time, they were used 8 hours a day, and people, humans, were trying to use the machines. And so the horrible result of that story was, and I think it's been changed since then, they banned all animals from getting MRIs. And so I had a lot of angry pet owners. And then they didn't do the obvious thing, which was, you know, hire more technicians to do people's MRIs at night. Look, things sometimes things go sideways on stories. I've been arrested on an investigation that kind of went when I was I did a sting on the liquor inspectors in Ontario, but they let me out of jail. There are a lot of things that go wrong, but fortunately there are more things, I think, that go right.
How far would you go? I was just thinking, I'm supposed to contribute here, apparently. When I went to find, I was looking for Carla Homolka, who is a serial killer who kidnapped and helped sexually torture and kill her little sister and two other young women. I hadn't heard of her, as we hadn't in Canada, after she disappeared from Quebec for about 5 years, and I had no interest whatsoever in trying to find her. But I do a lot of work online, and I began to see, because of the timing of another trial, that her name kept coming up. In fact, the woman who was on trial, it was as if Carla Homolka herself was on trial again, and everyone was saying, well, let's not have another Carla. In other words, it's a different case, it's a different accused, but let's make sure this woman gets the penalty that Carla Homolka, who ended up serving only 12 years for these gruesome crimes, got. And so sort of from a justice perspective, I thought, oh, that's wrong, and I'm a lawyer, that's really wrong. But as I was investigating, I thought, you know, where did she go? And I began to find what I considered to be pretty substantial information, that she had gone to the Caribbean, but that she was now teaching young girls the same age as the ones that she had helped kill. And even though she didn't face any conditions because of some strange court maneuvering at the end, the conditions the justice system had wanted to put on her were that she wasn't to go near young people. And it was at that point I thought, what do? You go and find out if it's true. It's not to find a serial killer. It's to find whether she is potentially going to harm again. But because of circumstances that were so bizarre, I wound up finding her on the second last day that I could afford to be in Guadeloupe, and there was nobody with me. So the guards who were going to come with me and accompany me, not in, because you would never get in with anybody more than one person, they had to go to work on their other job, and I knew I had. You know the window, right? You can feel it. And I wound up going into this place, meeting Carla Homolka, her husband, very angry husband, with a taxi driver that I realized had no idea where I was, because the building that I'd found her in was very large. You have a whole organization behind you, though.
But I still go into places on my own from time to time.
I can still see that picture of you sitting in the back of that taxi trying to get the crack video.
Yeah, but those guys they weren't that dangerous, really.
Tell us.
Oh, the crack video story? God.
What's it like? What's it like sitting in the back of a cab trying to negotiate, knowing your journalistic principles? You know, you're constantly weighing them. We don't pay for news. I
wish that had I been alone, I wish I had taken that goddamn video and and that phone from the guy and jumped over a wall and then would have saved everybody, including my newspaper, all sorts of drama and problems. The crack video story, which to me seems like a fun story now compared to the Gomeshi story. Went to meet, we were trying to see this video. Who wouldn't want to see a video of your mayor smoking crack cocaine? And we ended up going not to a taxi, just got into this guy's car and being driven to actually a place where I, one of the places I volunteer at is the Toronto Star's Santa Claus Fund. And every year, I, on my route with my wife and kids, is this group of buildings, which I can reveal now is actually where we saw the delivering Christmas presents. It is actually where, when we got to the parking lot to see the video, I thought, oh yeah, I know these buildings. This is where we deliver presents every December. And anyway, so the guy came out, it was about 10 o'clock at night, and for Robin and I, people said, were you scared? And I say, absolutely, we were scared. We were scared of failing. Mm-hmm. That's the fear. And we're not, I've been to wars, been shot at. That is like real fear. The fear here was that we were going to not see, we're going to see some crazy video that's not of Mayor Ford, or that he's not going to show us the video. We're not worried that he's going to pull out a gun and shoot us. That said, when he was arrested, eventually he was arrested with guns.
People love the war stories, literally and figuratively, the war stories that we carry. That's what people always want to hear from me. Well, how scary was it? Have you been scared? Did you keep going?
A couple of times, but you know, it's funny. I don't know if it's just a human reaction of mine or of other people, but I tend to feel that more a couple of hours later. In the moment, your adrenaline's pumping, and you're just, you know, you're there to get things done. You don't want to fail, you know, especially if you've flown somewhere, your crew is there, whatever. You know, the task is what you're trying to manage. It's at dinner, hours later, with a glass of wine, you're thinking, that was nuts. I don't know if I should have been there, actually. And it's, you know, but it's part of the business, and I think you do get better at managing as you get more experienced. And I think, you know, getting back to your earlier question about, you know, are we elitist if we're the investigative journalists? They're very rarely the youngest people in the newsroom.
Oh,
it's usually about the experience that has
no,
gotten
the ones
you to
they
that
can
role.
Lose, right? We don't need you anymore. You go out there.
And so I think, you know, by the time you find yourself in really scary situations, you've had a couple of those, and you do have some experience. You have a few coping skills for how you're going to get out of that. I mean, I remember there was a story years ago now about a guy who was a chiropractor in Quebec, actually, who was telling people that he could do crazy things. He could, you know, he could cure their terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. And we went to confront this guy to ask him some questions because he wasn't going to answer them any other way. And I had been told that he had a dog that he brought with him everywhere that was a retired Sûreté du Québec police dog that would leap at you on command. I mean, that dog had been trained to do that. And the producer I was working with said to me, if you see him come up, we're in the van, and he's got the dog, don't go out. And I remember saying, yeah, yeah, because I thought, you're kidding. We're all the way here, and I've been sitting in a van for 3 hours. I'm not going to jump out. We're just going to see what happens. And sure enough, he had the dog. And part of you is just, my task is to go ask this guy questions. And I've got maybe 40 seconds of reaction time, because he's there. The door to his office is there. And I've got to get out of the van and go do this. Part of you, way back here, the little tiny voice is going, you're insane. Wait till your mother finds out what you did today. And he didn't. But I remember as I was walking up to him, you know, it was like the slow-mo moment. You know, it's me looking at him. We both look at the dog. You look back, and you're trying to hold his eyes thinking, don't do it.
Diana just referred to one of the most unglamorous parts of being an investigative reporter. It's sitting for long hours in vans on stakeouts with a lot of people, some of whom you don't know, some of whom may have been doing the same thing for 2 or 3 days.
And there's no glamour in that.
There's no glamour, but there's a tension. If you get if you do the good that you set out to do, it's valuable. On the other hand, there's a flip side. We've talked a little bit about the excitement and the public good of our work. But what about, and the reason I was sort of talking about being all alone with Carlo Molka is it's really great when there's a team in a van out there. And it's really great, Kevin, and I think this is one of the reasons Jesse Brown came to you, when you have a company like the Toronto Star that has great lawyers, led by Bert Bruiser, the great lawyer who gets everybody out of trouble or keeps people out of trouble. That's what you do. How far has the Star gone to back you on a story?
Well, I've been sued a lot. I think I've been sued more than any journalist in Canada. I don't know if any of my lawyers are present.
How do you know that?
Because, well, certainly for many years I won the annual joke award for most lawsuits at the Star. I mean, there, at any given time, I've got 4 or 5 on the go. We get sued a lot.
Do you get nervous? People are laughing a little bit. But, I mean, lawsuits come with statements of claims that often have lots of zeros on them, and really nasty things are said in these documents about the quality of your work. Have you ever had that feeling in your stomach, like, ow?
I think probably many years ago when I first got sued, I was dragged through court by Pizza Pizza, of all companies, in the early 90s. And every summer for 5 years, I'd done with my colleague Dale Brazzo, I'd done an investigation. Pizza Pizza at that time was run by a guy who was a Canadian, but who was a convicted Florida racketeer, Lauren Austin. And Lauren was a larger-than-life character. And the allegations that we proved was that new immigrants were coming to Canada, and they would come with some money, and they would get a Pizza Pizza franchise, which cost about $250,000, at least in the early 90s. and they would invest their life savings. They wouldn't have all that money, but they would take out a loan or mortgage. And they were just being screwed, And we took up their cause and investigated it and had a lot of wild stories about pizza. It's pretty interesting. Well, the Pizza sued, and Lauren Austin sued. And every summer, if you can imagine this, I would spend 6 weeks being discovered by Lauren Austin's lawyers. And every year he wouldn't pay his lawyers. And then several of the lawyers went on to be judges, and I would see them in court on other things, and I would think, why do lawyers keep representing this guy? And eventually, after spending, I think, $750,000, the Star's money, to defend us, we got $14,400 in settlement money from him. Not quite as much as the CBC got from Jean Gomeshi, which was $18,000. And this audience doesn't laugh much. It's okay to laugh occasionally in life. And so I've been dragged through court, and but what I found that process did is that once you have been questioned for weeks and weeks on something, it makes you a better journalist now. So now, and also because of the responsible communication defense, the lawsuits don't last. They're not. It's easier to get rid of them, I find.
And also,
I will tell you, journalists in the room, Lauren Austin, who was my arch enemy, is my friend now. And he lives in Florida. He went back to Florida, and about 6 or 7 years ago, he emailed me one Christmas day and said, Merry Christmas. And I see him every once in a while, and he helps me out occasionally with stories. He emailed me just a couple of days ago saying that's quite the story. He looks at it from a different point of view. He looks at it as a former target of mine. And so he takes great glee in looking at the latest target, so to speak. Anyway, so lawsuits they can be nerve-wracking, but they can make you better, actually.
I want to just, with you on that topic of the Star backing you, have you ever been asked, I'm pitching this question to you, how many times have you been asked to reveal your sources? How many times have you revealed your sources? And what role did the Star play in that decision?
It was zero times revealing my source. I've had two times when a criminal court asked me to reveal a source. One was in this crazy liquor inspector case, and so where the Star was compelled, I was compelled to come and testify about stuff we'd done, and I refused to reveal. And the source, and in both cases, this judge decided not to make me a hero to journalists and did not send me to jail, which was a great disappointment to me. A short stint in jail, you could write about it. Cue the laughter. Sorry about the cue joke. In about 5 or 6 times in civil cases, which it's different. A civil case is different, and you were asked to reveal your source there, and the aforementioned Bert Bruiser and other counsel has somehow, stick-handled us out of that. It's very important when you have sources, you don't write their names down in a notebook, and you don't have it in your phone. Use code words, things like that, for your sources. And you can't. If I ever revealed a source, I'd be finished. I would just have to hang up the notebook.
Diana,
absolutely.
Do you talk about that? I mean, people come to us with stories, or we find them, mm-hmm. and you begin that negotiation that we're all familiar with. I need your information. You're the only place I can get it.
What can you tell me?
I'm going to try and help you tell the story without something awful happening. How far have you gone in your promises to a source?
I would say not that far, because I'm not interested in promising something I can't deliver. And it's been my practice to be very upfront with people and to say, yes, I want the information that you can give me. But you have to have a mature discussion with people, and I think it is born out of experience about how that dialogue works, and that, yes, I want to hear what you have to say, and no, I'm not going to be testing you at every second, but yes, I have to test what you're telling me. That's my job. It's how we would stop people from making malicious statements that get on the air or get in the paper, that we have to test it. That's important. So that dialogue takes place, but often not right away.
What if they say to you, I have something that if I tell you, people will track me down, mm-hmm. and you know, I'll be harmed, or I will lose my job, or I'm afraid for my family, and you know this is critical information.
Yeah, I mean, that's the discussion we have when we do conceal someone's identity. I mean, people will say, you know, I want to say something to you about a particular story, and I want you to conceal my identity. We don't just go, okay, that's fine. I mean, there has to be a test.
And why don't we? Why don't we say that?
For the very reason that then your neighbor can say ridiculous things about you and ruin your life. I mean, it's as simple as that. You could ruin each other's life so easily. We cannot be a conduit for that.
That's for the internet.
And exactly. Right. A lot of that gets going on by itself. Our test has to be very high. We need to be convinced. I need to be convinced as a journalist before I ask my bosses for permission to conceal someone's identity that they are at a real material risk if we identify them, that some real harm or cost could come to them for doing this. But then, you know, then you have to be able to get someone else to verify it. I mean, that's the role of the journalist, to make sure that the tests are high enough that when you do offer someone that protection, you've done it with your eyes open, and that you believe it is in the public interest and the public good to do it.
I really want to talk about hidden cameras right now, but Kevin, do you have a comment on
I'm not wearing
sources?
A hidden camera.
Beg your pardon?
I'm not wearing one.
Oh, it's all the rage in Ottawa. You should try
That's
it.
That's right.
Carrying a hidden camera around is both an ethical decision and, in some cases, a legal decision. What's your feeling about them?
Well, first of all, it's hard to get a good hidden camera.
It is, actually.
For a recent investigation, not Gomeshi, and not Orange, one in between, I bought some good hidden cameras, which cost $99 in New York City, and they're a watch. So that's not a bad one. We don't have the gear, I think, that CBC has. Our policy at the Star, all jokes aside, is in almost all cases, reporters must identify themselves. You must go into something saying, I'm Kevin Donovan with the Toronto Star, and I want to talk to you. However, there are times when we want to use a hidden camera. We have used them recently on a retirement home investigation where we wanted to get some video from inside a retirement home, and there was no other way to get it. And so we do it. I have to approve that, and I always make sure that my boss, Michael Cook, knows about that. So we don't use them a lot. It's a very small part
Why
of
not?
Our work.
I have some of my students, my journalism students here from Seneca at York. Thank you all for being here. It's an interesting discussion to have. How do you make a decision? I mean, we could just wear hidden cameras all the time. Why don't we?
Well, so for us, I mean, the majority of the work I've done in my career has been as a reporter. When I did the Orange Air Ambulance stories, which you know, caused a lot of change in this province, and were, I think, clearly in the public interest, there was no subterfuge in that at all. It was just me going out and interviewing people and getting documents. And I used sources, but I used sources to get people to answer questions. You know, you get information from a source, and then it's a good source, and you go to Orange, and they confess. That's the best way, I think, to do journalism. I don't like hidden cameras. We use them occasionally. If you were trying to get, I mean, our dream was to, you know, could you get a certain politician in a certain nightclub in a certain part of the city doing something? And sure, we tried that, but it didn't work out. But apart from that, I don't see a real need for it.
Diana, what about you? Because CBC has broken some great hidden camera stories.
Yeah. Again, the test is very high. I mean, as you said, the test has to be that you really cannot think of any other way to get this material. It's actually your last-ditch approach
Always.
As opposed to the first. You know, and in television, I mean, these things sometimes people, I think, are rightly cynical if it's used as a device. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a gimmick. So you really don't want to be using it a lot because it needs to be meaningful when you see it. Frankly, it's hard to do well.
Really hard.
Whether it's, you know, what did you say? It was a watch?
Well, these watches,
yeah,
but then you've
watches,
got
a
the
pens.
Reporter has to be like
yeah,
this.
I have the pen.
And,
but you know, there are glasses, purses. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, they're so tiny now, is that they are in your camera phone. They can be in anything.
But it's frightening.
But then you have to, you know, sit like this and try to frame up and hope the person doesn't notice that you're sitting in a ridiculous position. And, you know, I can think of one case where we thought we had this, you know, the glasses, and the guy went, I got those.
Seriously.
He had the glasses.
I think they look so phony.
Okay.
You know, they look even more fake than Google glasses.
It's very hard. I mean, some things obviously, luckily, are persuasive and have worked, and we have them as devices, and I won't list them all here because then nothing will work.
We may be coming for you.
It's actually very difficult to use that. So it's last ditch because logistically it can be tough, and it's last ditch because ethically it is the last place you should be going.
Right.
Sometimes, in the public interest, it's the route you have to take.
It's also last ditch because I don't think anybody knows this, but I actually did record my interview with Carla Homolka. You must have known I would. But I was terrified because I knew that if that was discovered, she was very angry with me. I really don't know what would have happened to me. After that hour with her, I feel very clear on what she's capable of. And it's frightening. And you also know, I mean, it doesn't have to be that dramatic. You also know that if somebody knocks your purse and your little camera, suddenly you can see it behind the brooch, it's over. You've spent all this time, not to mention money, to get this interview or this situation that you will never be able to recreate again.
And there can be a sense of physical security as a reporter when in my case, you know, it's a producer or it's a camera person who's with you. You've got one other physical body at least. With a hidden camera, it's usually in an environment where you're the only one. And if it goes sideways,
absolutely,
you know, you're calculating the whole time how you're going to manage that moment while you're also trying to do your job as a journalist and make sure that the interview is happening in the way that you need it to. You're asking the right questions, but you're over here, the gears are turning too. What happens if this all just, you know, the camera falls out?
Or
the camera gets moved. The person moves the very thing you've put down.
And
you've
got
to try and get it back.
And I think what Diane is talking about, too, is there's a very big distinction between print and broadcast. Of course, when you're in print, you're constantly, you want stuff for the website, and you don't want to just stick, you know, your text onto the website. But when you're working in television, I've worked in both, and when you're in TV, that's it. That's your product. If you don't get that shot, you can't hold up a paragraph that says, and then...
Yeah.
Right? I want, just in our closing moments, because we're going to save quite a lot of time for you to ask any questions you want. It's up to our stars here to decide whether they're going to answer them. We've talked a lot about doing what's right, the value of the story. Quite frankly, we have to admit it, the high of breaking a story that you know means something. What about the downside of being somebody who breaks the big stories? What does it mean about the other stories in your life, Kevin?
You mean the downside or the...
Well, I mean, when your stories break, they break huge. So is the Gian Gomeshi case, for example, the first sexual assault case you've ever covered?
No. In fact, in 1989, I did an investigation called Silent Sins. It was my first investigation, and it was certainly in this country, the first investigation of Catholic priests who were moved from my mother gave me the idea, actually, for that. And I'm not kidding you. And I showed that these priests were moved from one parish to another rather than being sent off for any sort of prosecution. I think maybe, Paul, because we did have this little conversation before, and I have a pet peeve. My pet peeve is that everybody, including other media, focuses a lot on the Gian Gomeshi story. You focus a lot on the Rob Ford story. And I would say that by 9 a.m., I had done 20 radio interviews from across the country, just people that call up and they want to have you on for 3 or 4 minutes. And I love doing radio because I can do it when I'm driving, hands-free, of course, and a few TV interviews. When I did the Orange story, there was not the same interest in it, but there was a fair bit of interest, but it died down very, very quickly. We've done many stories that, if you gauge the interest of the public in a story in whether other media is interested, I did a story, one of the things I'm most proud of was an investigation of people with developmental challenges. It was called Nowhere to Go, and it was about people who were intellectually challenged. They would be in their early 50s, and their parents who were looking after them were now 80. and those parents are dying off, and because of the deinstitutionalization, people are living with their parents, which is great, and they have nowhere to go. There was not one call from any other media. Nobody picked up on the story. It actually had a huge impact in this sector and the province. It fixed some things that they should have fixed before on their own. But people aren't interested in those stories. Yeah. And so it frustrates me that a Gomeshi story, everybody wants to talk about it. And it has had some positive impacts. But there's so many, many other stories. We did this TDSB story today on violence in schools, and I don't know, did anybody cover it? No?
I think it's a good point. I mean, my most recent frustration on that very point is that we did a story about pilots at Air Canada leaving pornography in the flight deck.
Everybody was talking about that in my classes.
But you know, I fear that they were talking about it for the wrong reason.
Absolutely.
Right,
well,
that
no,
it was
no,
a joke. And it's... I get why people laugh, but it's not a joke. It's sexual harassment in its most direct form. One of the pictures that was found was a picture of a woman engaged in a sex act with a knife drawn in at her back.
Wow.
That's in your workplace? That's not right. And it, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, yes, it's great when people follow your stories and when they don't follow your stories, but there are some where you wish everybody would sit up and go, you know what, this matters. This is important. This is not okay in 2014 in someone's workplace. And the amount of email I got from men who purported to be pilots, and based on, you know, looking at the way they wrote the email, my guess is they are, I got more than enough from men who said, yeah, what's the big deal? This has been going on forever. But we hide it. If they find it, it's because they're looking for it. So,
you know, actually,
what?
I wasn't.
This is wrong, and we should be paying attention to it. But it didn't, for my purposes, get the attention it should have. It got the, this is kind of funny, attention.
I just want to be clear. I didn't have that reaction, and no one I knew did. In fact, the reason we were talking about it was we couldn't believe it, that the people who we were entrusting our lives to fly these planes were this juvenile, this frightening, and this misogynist. And I think that's why we're talking about it. But I wonder why we're still not talking about it, because it's along the lines of the other kinds of sexual assault that recently have been maintaining their weight in the headlines.
You know,
I think you should revisit that.
It is about the zeitgeist, right? That something takes hold. This national conversation is happening now. The Gomeshi story, what's happened in Ottawa with the allegations from the NDP MPs. You know, maybe it's the pilots thing. It's, you know, conversations that are taking place now that have been driven by a whole bunch of different factors, that there's suddenly attention. People are paying attention to something that's actually been an issue for a very long time. And it's important now. And does it matter how we got there? Probably not. It's good, though, that a conversation is taking place.
But people are more interested in personalities. If you have two very strong personalities, Rob Ford and Jean Gomeshi, and stories about them have electrified people, and people are really interested, and they talk about it constantly, probably maybe way too much, certainly in Ford's case. I'm fascinated by it. It's a relatively new experience for me, and it's just one wonders what's next. Who's next? Hopefully nobody in this room.
Well, no, what I wonder is, what do you talk about when these big stories break? Now, why do you think about them? Why do we gravitate toward them? What I'd really like to know, you can think about that overnight and let me know in the morning, but what would you like to ask? There's a microphone right there. We'd love to chat with you about absolutely anything. Is that true?
Yeah.
Sure,
pretty much.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
Pretty much. Join us. Yeah, take the mic, because I think we're running some cameras here.
Thank you very much for your comments. I'm curious to know, the three of you have been recognized for largely local or domestic or national stories. What are the hindrances to investigative journalism on larger international stories involving great powers or activities overseas? Are there industrial concerns within the journalism industry, or what thwarts more exposure of investigative journalism overseas?
I would argue that the CBC does a fair bit of that. My travel schedule for a while there would indicate that that's all I was doing. And I have colleagues around the globe who do investigative journalism in other parts of the world. So I don't know that there's any kind of industrial holdback. The one impediment, well, I would say there are probably more. One is money. clear and simple, these stories can be very difficult to do, because you're not going home every night. You're going to a hotel. There are real measured costs against doing that kind of work. The other is access to places sometimes, access to information. You're dealing with entirely different ways of getting information in different countries. As frustrating as it often is to get information in this country, try doing it in other parts of the world. It's not easier. So I don't know that there's any lack of interest or lack of commitment to it. Sometimes it's difficult to do.
Yeah, and I should just say, we're really lucky. Any journalist who tells you that they just drop down with a parachute into a foreign country where they don't speak the language and they don't really even know where they are, that the bakery are in the middle of the munitions plant. We have something called fixers, people that are paid usually by our media outlets who live in that, or work in that area, who speak that language and probably many, many more, who know precisely what's going on. And they are journalists that are paid to work with us. We still have to get on the ground. We still have to break the story with them. But they're really, really important parts, typically, of what we do. I don't think there's any... I'd love to do more foreign investigation. It's really expensive because, one, you need more staff. You have to stay somewhere. And it could be dangerous, but danger is not something that I'm particularly afraid of anymore, just because you do it over and over and over again.
Not my team, but Lynn McCauley's team at the Star did a great investigation called The Clothes on Our Back, and it was about sweatshops overseas. So we do them. That is a story we did because it had a connection to our readers, to people in Canada. And to just go off and start, investigating ISIS, for example, is not something, like, you'd sort of need to have a reason to do the story. We're not against it, and we've done them. But I do think we do tend to focus more on things that are immediately relevant to Canadians. And the clothing one, it's an international investigation that fit that bill.
I got another question back there. Hello, what's your name and who are you with?
My name is Tara, and I'm just here as
a
guest.
You're just Tara.
Just Tara.
Good for you.
Just
welcome.
Tara. Diana, you spoke of, the power, a positive force of investigative journalism. The story in Manitoba, you brought light to a tragedy that was going on in Manitoba. And I think, you got action immediately. I think you said the Minister of Native Affairs brought a check up there, and it must have been very, very satisfying. Kevin, when I've been reading the story about Gameshi, and I thought it's probably really difficult to have victims come forward because alleged victims or victims of alleged sexual assault a lot of times don't want to come forward because they've been trashed before. They've seen other victims being trashed in court, and everyone knows it's so hard because it can take years out of your life through the courts, and then nothing's happened because, the defense has fantastic lawyers, et cetera, and nothing ever comes to fruition through court. But of course, with Gameshi, right away, his earning potential is gone. I'm sure he's going to be into the hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees just to defend this. It's going to go on for years. And I'm sure you did a lot of fact-checking, obviously. Otherwise, this story never would have come to light. Does it give you any kind of satisfaction that even 2-3 years from now, if Gameshi's found not guilty, in a way he's been found guilty in the court of public opinion?
I'm pleased that the people have come forward and told their stories and that more are feeling empowered to do that. What happens, whether he's charged, whether he was charged or not charged, and now whether he's convicted or not convicted, I don't think that is, that's not something that is in my purview. I can't, that's up to the criminal justice system. And I really do believe that. I mean, that's, we'll continue to follow the case throughout the courts. And it's going to be a rough ride for the three who've come forward, and they know that. But I think the important thing is that they felt that they could tell their stories in at least the way they did. I mean, one person or two people now have come out and put their names to it, which, as you can imagine, is a pretty tough thing to do.
And also, I think it's important, and we're governed by these ethics. You don't go after a story as a reporter because you're vindictive in any way. And I don't think I've ever felt that in a story. But if you ever were to feel that, you need to withdraw immediately. The absence of malice, which is a great film, it means exactly that. We're supposed to be objective, we're neutral, we're fair, whatever you want to call it. And that means not having an end game with anything. Mm-hmm. You're simply there to find the facts, report the facts. And people who are empowered and trained to reach the next set of conclusions, you let them do that, right? Yeah. We have another question back there. Yes.
I'm Allison Motlock of Freelancer. It's one thing to break a great story, but one of the things I love about The Star is that you follow the story, and you take it till you explore it fully. I'm wondering if you could give advice to the rest of us about what techniques to use to make sure you can complete the story.
Great question, by the way, Allison. It's great.
Well, to do this job, you have to be naturally curious, and you have to try and get every possible angle covered on a story. You have to be a good listener. I mean, that's the thing that I think is the most important thing for a journalist, is that you listen, that you don't, I'm talking a lot now, it's more in my nature to listen, that you ask good questions and you hear what people say. When we do these stories, whether you talk about Ford or Gomeshi or Orange, when we publish them, we put our contact information at the bottom, and we do that. I don't do that so that I can get a lot of hate mail, but I do, and a lot of positive mail too. I do it so that somebody sees that and either tells me more about that particular story, or in some cases they'll say, "Geez, the Star in our case is looking at exploring tough issues. Maybe I will trust them with the story." But it's really important that you do never give up on a story once you have published it. It's really important. And Orange Air Ambulance, for any of you who remember that story, I actually did an investigation in 1991 of the forerunner of Orange and exposed a lot of problems there. And I guess I didn't do a very good job, because out of the ashes of what I wrote about grew this guy, Chris Mazza, who ended up taking the province for quite a ride. And it was the same sources from 1991 who the pilots and the paramedics who were still at this, they were at this new beast, who called me up in 2011 and said, "Hey, guess what? While you were off doing your investigations of charities and stuff like that, guess what happened?" So it's important to listen to people. I mean, it's not an exact science. Journalism is not at all an exact science.
Hi there.
I have a question for Kevin about the...
Can you tell us who you are first?
Sure, I'm Neil. I work at CBC. I have a question for Kevin about the Gian Gomeshi stories. Had the CBC not fired him, would you have eventually published the story? And also, had he not written the Facebook post, would you ever in a million years have gotten that story in the paper?
Yes. but that was my goal. And there were various things that I was trying to do to get that story. Would I have been successful? I don't know. I think so, though. I always think that things will come out. That's why when I, a few weeks before, ended up oddly at dinner with him, I was polite but tried to get him to answer questions. How it happened on that particular weekend, once we knew that there was an issue, we began doing our work to prepare the stories that we had. And it wasn't the Facebook posting. It was simply the fact that they fired him, and that our sources, and my sources, told us that it was because of this. That they had all the information that we had given to him, and he had passed it on to them. And what's interesting about that, how that all happened that day, is that I think he was, they sent out a press release from CBC at around 1 or 2 o'clock saying that he was fired. And it was an agreed upon release. And the release that they had agreed was saying that, we wish him well or something like that, a very neutral release. And I immediately called up Chuck Thompson and had said, I'm gonna send them again, but I know you already have all these letters from me where I had detailed allegations and sent them back in June to Mr. Gomeshi. And in asking him, I don't know if this was planned or not, but what he said inflamed Gomeshi. He said there was something that we saw which precluded us from continuing to employ him. And my understanding is that he just, Gomeshi went nuts at that and was very, very upset that they would, in his opinion, breach the deal, that he would go quietly into the good night. And so that started this cascade. And it was very helpful that he published what he did on Facebook when he talked about the BDSM, because then we had more of his side of the story. So that's a long way of saying, I think we would have eventually, would it have been published now? I don't know. If he had, in the summer, or at my dinner with him, if he had said just a few more words, where he had, if he had said, look at, you know, I do these things, but it's all part of my role as in the BDSM community, which I do not believe to be the case, then that would have given us enough. And he was clever enough not to give us that in at that time, but he did with Facebook.
Thank you, big time.
Yeah.
Back there, who are you?
Hi,
welcome.
I'm Rita Tritcher, and I work for the Wall Street Journal here in Toronto. I have a question for actually the three of you. It's a kind of a practical question. Kevin, you gave a very good tip about, you know, being very careful with your notes and using code words and not writing people's names down. But I'm always curious to know from other journalists, what's the safest way, or what are the techniques you use to communicate with very confidential sources? Hmm. For all three of you.
In person, for one. I have some sources who won't use anything that's connected to anything. And they especially won't use wireless. Doesn't matter what the firewalls are, doesn't matter what you promise, just no way, because it isn't safe, obviously. An in-person meeting isn't particularly safe either, unless, you know, you happen to know a couple of places that it's really hard to surveil. And the other thing is, it's so funny, because you don't want to say what you want to say. They have to be comfortable. That's
tweet that.
Pardon?
Somebody tweet that.
Tweet that. But your sources really have to be comfortable, because if they're not, then you're not going to get the interview, you're not going to get the story. So it's a negotiation. What do you do?
I do talk to sources.
You were in the garage. I remember reading you went into the garage and talked to someone.
Oh, yeah. You've got to meet people in garages. I meet people in strange places. I also talk to people on phones. Sources, there's different levels of sources. There's the person who wants to be your background source. It might be, let's say you're doing an investigation on a company, and I would say to the person who, let's say, works at this company, don't email me from your office. Like, don't do that. So set up an email at home, and you can communicate with me to my star email or to my home email. But the first meeting, so sources, the thing is, everybody wants to be a source. Everybody who calls up these days wants to be completely confidential, and I do not allow that. There's got to be some people who, you've got to have some names in the paper, or your editors are not going to publish the story. So you do have to take precautions. I have conversations with them where I explain to them things like, you know, don't use your work email, don't tell people that you're my source. And people have done that. Well, yeah. I talked to, you know, I gave Kevin Donovan that story.
So
well, fine, thank you. But, and there's been sources in the Orange story. There's a fellow who was a really good source named Jacob Bloom. And Jacob was very, very helpful to me in breaking that story. And after about 6 or 7 weeks of what was a series of news breaks that we did, it became apparent to him that somebody was going to out him. And I said to him, okay, look, you know, I'll protect you, of course, I'll never admit, but maybe you want to come out in the Star as our source and say that you did this. And we talked about it, and he said, yeah. And we took a picture of him, and so he revealed himself as a source. That was his choice to do, and I think it was a really good thing. I think it was a really smart thing to do, and he ended up testifying anyways.
I think it's really important. Sources are, unnamed sources or anonymous sources are just about the worst thing ever for a journalist. It's not something you go out and do. You can't be a journalist and have a bunch of anonymous sources. So you actually begin the negotiation way up here. I have to name you. I have to name you. Well, you can't name me. Why can't I name you? Well, I can protect you on these different things. Oh, okay. And so sometimes you'll get a name, or sometimes you'll get a position, but you won't get a full name, especially with government officials. But you know, it's down here. You lower the level. You risk your credibility, and you risk a sense of disbelief among your readers.
But do you mean I mean, we would never publish anything from an anonymous person that we don't know.
Exactly.
It's to us, they're confidential, and it drove me freaking crazy that the Fords would always say that, you know, we were pathological liars and maggots, and we used all these anonymous sources. Well, they weren't anonymous to us. We knew who they were. But we had promised to make them confidential.
Exactly. So I should not be too much of a professor here, but anonymous sources would be people who call you up and say, I know he did that because. You can't test that, so you can't use that. It might be a tip to go and hang out at night where they're unloading the carts out of the back of a truck. But even with confidential sources, we have to have names. And the tabloids that say, so-and-so said, well, who's so-and-so, and how do we know them? They said that, and we're not going to actually believe you anymore. And that's the thing you never want to risk, especially the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, CBC. You just don't want to risk it.
And to your point of how do you meet with people, you know, face-to-face communication, no matter how much technology advances, the stuff that worked the best 40 years ago still works the best now. A face-to-face conversation with someone. I mean, the problem sometimes, I mean, whether it's Kevin or myself, even within the journalism community, we're recognized, so that can be difficult. Although more often than not, if I'm meeting someone outside of, you know, not wanting to be seen, I will show up the way I look on the weekends, and I'll guarantee you most people don't know it's me at all. They think maybe I've seen her; she's my dental hygienist. But they don't put it together. People get it wrong all the time.
Someone from high school.
Yeah, you know, I think I know her, but I don't know why.
But just as a follow-up.
In person, but you know, nobody wants to deal with email. I don't blame them. People don't want to deal with the technology that they think is not secure.
No.
A landline phone is the one thing I won't give up.
Okay, and just as a follow-up, I'm also a big believer in meeting people face-to-face. I'm just curious where the ideal place to meet people is, because you know, I work in this area, and I'm a business reporter, and I am very paranoid about meeting people in the path or any restaurants around here, because there's a lot of cameras and people walking around. I'm just curious, you know, can you give some really good creative examples of places where if you had to meet someone? I mean, I had to meet someone in a bathroom the other day, but I'm just curious about what you guys have done and just something.
Well, being
sounds like quite a story. I look forward to reading that.
Cement.
But, you know, sometimes just like a coffee shop, a diner, but, you know, don't do a Starbucks. You know, don't meet at the place where you know you're going to see a whole bunch of people come and go. You know, find the kind of place you actually probably don't want to buy any food and just go and grab a coffee.
Or cement. Meet in cement. It's incredible how easy it is to lose your wireless, for people to hang out. You know, meet in like cement places. They're everywhere in the city. They're especially everywhere underground. And you just do a scan, like you constantly scan. And cameras don't look like cameras, right? Cameras look like little balls, or they look like little pieces of this. But if you're in a cement slab, it's unlikely anybody's going to be able to catch your audio, and it's very unlikely anyone's going to be able to see you. But, you know, be careful.
I live in Etobicoke, as I think a lot of people know, there's lots of great places to meet in Etobicoke.
Gentlemen, right back
Parks.
Here.
John Moody, Loyola's college student. Two questions. First one, simple but important. As a journalism student, you spoke about experience, but that comes with time. What can a journalism student do, or a new journalist do, to break into the field, or what kind of skills can they practice to so that they can someday get to that point where they can practice investigative journalism? The second question, can investigative reporting be done by an independent journalist, or does it need the help of a major news media legal team?
I'm just going to jump into the first point. My first investigative story, which actually turned out to be a big story at the time, you know, I stumbled into it, which is so often the case, but I was 24. To say I was inexperienced is really not to put too fine a point on it. And I was able to work with other people who had more experience to take that story along. And It was about an immigration consultant who we were able to show had an inappropriately close relationship with the federal director of immigration at the time. And we had proof that the federal director was going on vacations paid for by this immigration consultant, and it resulted in charges, people lost their jobs. But, you know, I was really green. I had, you know, a couple of years really as a full-time journalist at that point. I was very young. My answer to that is, if you've got a good story, being a young journalist doesn't mean you can't pursue it or you can't get into investigative journalism. But as you would in any environment, use the talent you can find around you to use their expertise to help guide you through it. And that gets actually to your second point. If it's a big story and you know there are going to be legal issues that you might need some protection as a journalist to be able to tell the story, I think there is a lot of merit in going to a larger organization, as happened with the Gomeshi story. You're not just pulling on the legal support, but you're pulling on a whole bunch of experience from people who have been down this road before.
You might be surprised to hear that people sue you even when they really don't have a legal foot to stand on, and they do it by way, you know, sort of prior censorship or in an attempt to scare you off showing up more of the story. I've done some reporting with CTV behind me, and I've done, as an investigative reporter with W5, and I've done some independent reporting. Carla Homolka was independent. There's great things about both. Everything here is fantastic. Being independent, you make your own decisions, probably some more dangerous ones than you would have, but they can also pay off. So if you're asking about getting in, the skills, learn how to use your computer. Pick up on your computer research and your reporting skills. That half of the story, you know, tracking down a serial killer was 2 weeks in front of my computer. And the other half was just boots on the ground. You could do a lot by just researching. It's amazing. And you practice that, you're good to go.
I have a slightly different philosophy on that. I think the Toronto Star made me an investigative reporter by making me go to murder scenes and making me go to fires and flower shows and all that stuff that you do as a young journalist. Tim's smiling back there because we sent him to LA on the Gomeshi story, and you do get to do stuff like that. There's a lot of things that you do as a young journalist that provide you with the ability to do things like, you know, meet a crack dealer and look at a video of the mayor. That allow you to sit with a guy that knows that you're investigating him for beating up women at an event and just have a conversation with him. When I talk to journalism students, I talk a lot about schmoozing, which, and if you were my class, I would say, do you guys know what schmoozing is? And every once in a while, somebody will get it, and that is the ability to talk and to get and to listen and get information out of people. And I think that is the most important part about being a journalist. Yes, you sit at a computer, you learn how to do database scraping and things like that, but I shout it from the rooftops, you learn to be an investigative journalist. First of all, you learn to just be a journalist, because it's all the same thing.
That's excellent to wrap us, because we began by saying, what is the difference between being a news reporter and being an investigative reporter? And indeed, it is time, experience, learning how to do that, knowing how to do the research to confirm, finding your sources, and then breaking the story.
And one thing, learn to use the phone. I still marvel sometimes at people who have, you know, a master's, don't know how to talk on the phone. You know, you have to get people to talk to you. You have to get people to tell you things they actually naturally don't want to give up. Not everybody's calling you enthusiastically saying, I have a great tip. You've got to go find them. And you have to get people comfortable telling you stuff, people who don't know you. Talking on the phone is a skill, and it's too undervalued in my, you know, everybody wants to tell you about the data mining they can do, and it's valuable, but you've got to know how to have a conversation with someone.
You have to be able to do all of it. I'm a big data miner, so I'm standing up for that. This is we've come to the end of our time here, which is sad, and yet there's all kinds of more sessions next year. I'd just like to thank Kevin Donovan from the Toronto Star and Diana Swain from the Fifth Estate at, you know, you're an investigative reporter with CBC. Are you with the Fifth?
At CBC, that means I work everywhere.
She does everything they make her do. That's right. I'd just like to show some appreciation for them, because it's great to have you out. and mostly you. Fantastic. This is such a wonderful turnout. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paula. Good evening. I'm Natalie Turvey, Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. It's been a genuine pleasure to hear in challenging times for the news business that investigative reporting is thriving, it's having impact, and that news organizations continue to recognize the value of journalism that matters. On behalf of the foundation, we're so grateful to have had this opportunity to hear from three journalists who are committed to pursuing big stories, important stories that make a difference. Please join me in a round of appreciation for our moderator, Paula Todd. This is the last J-Talk of the season. I'd like to thank BMO Financial Group for making this series possible and for supporting the work of the CJF. We're back in January, so check out the CJF website and Twitter feed for information on upcoming events. I hope you'll stay and join us for the cocktail reception and meet our panelists and continue the conversation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great.
Thank you.
Good job, Dan. Good job. Awesome. Paula. Well done.